They are scared. They're having problems to sleep in the night. The bombs, the violence in the street. So they don't grow as children.
Minors between ages of 14 and 15 come to the theater 2 days a week to attend drama workshops. The main aim is to tackle the fear and trauma children here are living through, especially after the latest Israeli military raid.
The Freedom Theater is my second home. I love to come here to learn and play, to take part in plays, to entertain other children after what we saw during the Israeli incursions that has left martyrs and destruction and prisoners.
The theater means everything to me. We can find a space to express ourselves after the hard circumstances we go through and after the latest raid. Here I can gather with my friends, we laugh and play and feel safe. The teachers here take us on journeys and we visit other Palestinian cities.
Younger children, however, are the most affected by the current situation, and the Freedom Theater continues to hold therapy workshops for such kids. The theater's experts and coordinators, who directly work with the children, say many of them are too traumatized to speak, and that's why they use art as a tool for expressing what they feel. They say art can convey what sometimes cannot be said.
During the recent raids on Jenin, the children were affected both direct and indirectly. We tried to give them a space just to play. Many of the children returned after the raids, suffering from shocks, worry, and fear. One of our goals is to let children express their feelings. We try to explain to them that there are different forms of resistance. Remaining in our land and learning at school is another form of resistance.
Last July, during the deadly military raid on the refugee camp, many were killed and wounded, and the theater and its vicinity were damaged. But it emerged from the ashes and immediately organized activities to cheer up the camp's children through drawing and singing. The Freedom Theater in Jenin refugee camp continues to provide some relief to the camp's children. This theater has survived miraculously despite difficult situations at the camp, Israeli occupation, and more recently airstrikes during the latest Israeli military operation in the camp. Mona Qandil occupied Jenin refugee camp.
The United States announced they are sending depleted uranium shells for tanks to Ukraine, even though they pose the risk of serious civilian health issues for generations. The use of such toxic shells by the United States in Fallujah, Iraq, is often blamed there for an increase in cancer, birth defects, and infant mortality. Depleted uranium shells now follow F-16 fighter jets, cluster munitions, tanks, and other escalatory measures which Washington had said they would refrain from using in the conflict.
Piles that much more of an atrocity on the atrocities that we're already committing, the atrocity of overthrowing the democratically elected leadership of Ukraine and forcing it into a 9-year race war. Is a horror that should have taught Americans long before this that their government does not care about Ukraine, does not care about Russia, and it's a hard pitch to say that they care about America either.
The toxic shells were announced during a surprise visit to Kiev by the United States Secretary of State, where he announced another $1 billion in funding.
The new security funding that we're announcing today will also be bolstered by the arrival of U.S. Abrams tanks this fall, and by training for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in the United States, complementing training that is already underway in Europe. In the ongoing counteroffensive, progress has accelerated in the past few weeks. This new assistance will help sustain it and build further momentum.
So far, the U.S. has given some $80 billion to Ukraine, or an average of nearly $1 billion per week since the unrest increased in February 2022. All the Western military aid has so far failed to succeed. The Ukrainian counteroffensive has barely dented Russian defenses. Western tanks often smolder on the battlefield. U.S. leaders now admit the war will continue for years. The obvious Russian success has many questioning the alleged military supremacy of the United States and NATO.
I think that there's no way that the West can win this war, and we're not fighting it to win it. We're fighting it to wear Russia down, using Ukraine as our blunt instrument to wear Russia down, smashing our friends, our allies, into the brick wall in hopes of knocking a few bricks out. But the narrative that has been sold to, is being relentlessly sold to Americans, is that we're on the verge of winning.
Congress is currently negotiating a bill for another $20 billion in weapons, even as polls show 55% of Americans don't want more funding for Ukraine. The influx of money has led to such rampant allegations of bribery that it just forced the replacement of Ukraine's Minister of Defense. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
With the efforts of Iranian experts, Iran managed to move and install a 3,200 platform in the South Pars gas field in July. The platform, which was the heaviest of its kind in the entire gas field, was installed in a complex and unique operation in the Persian Gulf. The operation had a 20-year delay due to Western sanctions.
Although we signed contracts with several foreign companies for 20 years, these contracts were not fulfilled due to Iran's international conditions and the indifference of foreign companies. As a result, Iran relied on its domestic capabilities to develop this oil platform.
In 2008, Total and Petronas announced that high development costs in the wake of rising steel prices had forced them to delay a final decision on investment after Iran had repeatedly extended a deadline. Tehran finally dismissed them from the project, which was overshadowed by haggling over contract terms. Despite all these obstacles, Iran now has managed to produce gas through the platform after its installation.
Although one-third of the field is in our possession and the other two-thirds are located in the geography of Qatar, we are ahead in terms of production. Today we are producing between 600 and 700 million cubic meters of gas, which is equivalent to 4 million barrels of oil.
The economic benefits of completing Phase 11 of the South Pars gas field are numerous. It is estimated to create up to 10,000 jobs and bring $20 billion of income to Iran. In addition, it will help revive Iran's oil and gas sector, which has been struggling over the years due to sanctions and low investment. Drilling of new wells at Phase 11 is an important step in Iran's drive to achieve energy independence and geopolitical stability, which will dramatically increase the gas production capacity at South Pars. It will meet Iran's domestic consumption needs and help the country emerge as an important regional exporter.
This great achievement by Iran shows that countries under sanction, including Iran, can neutralize unilateral Western sanctions by relying on their domestic capabilities. Farzana Shuryan, Asaluye.
On Friday, a 24-hour national strike was called by a number of base unions representing airline personnel, airport workers, and ground handlers in Italy. As a result of the industrial action, over 100 domestic and international flights were cancelled, with great delays recorded in a number of airports, including those of Milan, Venice, and Verona. It was the 18th strike involving airport and airline personnel in Italy this year. Travelers are feeling that they are left bearing the brunt of the clash between aviation sector companies and their workers.
They are not able to find a mutually satisfying deal. It must be said that workers have been deprived of their social rights over the past years.
I'm from Madrid. I just got here. I don't know if I'll be able to reach my destination today. It's very annoying.
Aviation sector workers have gone berserk as airline fares have skyrocketed over the past year and their salary levels have remained the same, if not worsened.
Union's main demand concerns airport ground service workers' collective agreement covering wages. The latest contract expired 6.5 years ago. In the meantime, inflation has really eaten into wages.
In our airports, we've got insecure, low-paid jobs which push workers into poverty. Some employees are forced to accept part-time jobs for less than 800 euros a month. Some others have to pay for parking their car in the workplace car parking areas, let alone their undignified working conditions. The logic behind this is the same as usual. Services offered at the cheapest rate. We have left the market in the hands of companies, and this is the result.
Goods and services prices in Italy have gone up dramatically since the start of the war in Ukraine. The 2022 annual inflation rate stood at over 8 percentage points, the highest level since 1985. Inflation stands at 6% today. A combination of high cost of living, skyrocketing costs of borrowing money, and insufficient fiscal support has caused a crunch that is felt at nearly every level in the country. Max Cibili, Rome.
There is no end in sight to the suffering of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip amid Tel Aviv's inhumane practices. The Israeli regime has placed a ban on the export of goods from Gaza to the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds since Tuesday, further exacerbating the dire economic situation in the impoverished territory. The Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, has been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007. Israeli security forces claim to have thwarted an attempt to smuggle explosive materials through the crossing on Monday. Observers say the Israeli claim is possibly an excuse for future military aggression against the Gaza Strip.
The impact of the restrictions and the siege is very harsh and very hard against Palestinian people. I think this comes in order to continue this collective punishment against Palestinians who's living in Gaza and to give Israeli government a justification for any military action.
The Israeli decision to ban exports from Gaza has inflicted heavy losses on the private sector and its various segments. It has deprived businessmen and manufacturers of the ability to market their products, disrupting production and employment.
Stopping exports from the Kerem Shalom crossing has had a grave impact on many factories in Gaza, including my factory. Currently, I'm working with only one-third of my employees because I can't afford to pay salaries. If this catastrophic situation continues, I will lose my business and all my employees will be out of work.
In addition to the ban on exports, the Israeli regime limits the quantity of the goods allowed into the impoverished territory and bans the entry of most raw materials for factories. The Palestinian NGOs Network, which represents over 140 Palestinian civil society organizations, says Tel Aviv's move to ban exports will further complicate living conditions in Gaza. According to officials in Gaza, businesses are losing $500,000 daily because of the export ban. Experts say the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip since 2007 has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and has had grave humanitarian consequences. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Twenty-three-year-old Wazir Azrar arrives at the Federal Agency for Asylum Seekers in Brussels, having been in Belgium for 6 months. Wazir says Western powers destroyed his country, Afghanistan, and now help is not available. Officials at the agency rejected his documents.
I have been waiting for that for 6 months. I've been sleeping on the street, also like in the park, yeah. This is a big problem here in Belgium for the Afghan refugees and also for the Syrian refugees, you know.
A coach full of families then arrives, and those people are granted access to the asylum application centre. This is because the Belgian government, led by Alexander De Croo, says male refugees travelling alone are no longer welcome in the country.
They're thinking we are just animals in refugees. They don't respect us. That's why I came here. For example, we need like doctors, like these very important things, but they don't care also.
Hundreds of men, mainly from Africa and the Middle East, are sleeping on the streets of Belgium. At the same time, the country is providing full protection to 62,000 Ukrainian refugees. They enjoy the same rights as EU citizens. The European Commission says it is aware of reports that Belgium is rejecting asylum applications from non-Ukrainian single men.
We understand that these are announcements at this stage, so this is still being discussed by the Belgian government, so we will need to see what is exactly happening, and the Commission will be contacting also the Belgian authorities in this respect.
De Croo's administration insists families, women and children must be prioritised as winter approaches. Groups such as Amnesty International claim the Belgian government has reached a new low. They are demanding that authorities here start respecting EU asylum laws and international asylum laws. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Is there a new war brewing in the Caucasus as Azerbaijan has been building up its forces on the Armenian border? In 2020, Azerbaijan fought another war against Armenia, ending in its victory. Now, Russia brokered peace talks and the agreement between the two sides at that time. There was land at the Azeris seized in exchange for Baku to keep certain roads and crossings open to the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Now, this is the region that several wars have been fought over between the two sides. This region is inside of Azerbaijan, but the people living there are ethnically Armenian. We're going to talk about all of this and where it seems to be headed on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests now to the program. Rostam Sabranov, political analyst of Russia Sokno News Agency out of Washington, D.C. Unur Erem, political analyst out of Istanbul. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start it off in D.C. And Rostam, why has the tension been rising now between Azerbaijan and Armenia again?
Hello, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming.
So we can observe the tensions building up for quite a while already. I think they're all dictated by the reason of Azerbaijani leadership to find the final resolution of that conflict and win entire territory of Karabakh for Azerbaijan and just force Armenian side under the military pressure to accept the terms of Azerbaijan.
Okay, well, Onur, how important, let's talk about the Nagorno-Karabakh region. How important is this region and why?
It's certainly important for not just for the region, for the world. The Transcaucasus is pretty much the main bridge between East and the West. It also has even greater importance linking Turkey to the rest of the Turkish republics out in Central Asia. So no matter which way you look at it from, it has importance in many different levels and in many different aspects, be it economic, be it political, be it geopolitical. So, it's the center of East and West, so to speak. I mean, what is linking between China and the rest of Asia to Europe and the rest of the West is this very particular region.
Well, Rostam, in your perspective, who benefits or which country benefit from increased tension in this region?
I think that's obviously Azerbaijan and Turkey pressing on. And of course, simultaneously, accidentally, United States too, because they would like to have Russia being troubled in that area. And Russia is right now in a very difficult position because Russia is a peace broker between Armenian and Azerbaijanian side. And right now, Russia could not really interfere more seriously than already in. So, and of course, when Armenian side is appealing for help to the West and trying to get involved with the military assistance of NATO, for Russia it's very troubling because Russia considers that part of the area, southern Caucasus, as a zone of the traditional interests. So we could see multiple interests involved here, but obviously most important it's Azerbaijan who wants totally restore control over their territory.
No, your take, I mean, Russia, as I said in the intro, played a role in the 2020 war and bringing it to an end. Of course, right now, Russia is very busy with its situation with Ukraine. Has the situation gotten worse because of that, because Russia is actually involved, too involved in dealing with its own situation to try to help broker a peace with this? Or how do you see that side of things?
I am pretty sure Russia, having its hands full with the situation in Ukraine, has not helping the situation or bringing a resolution to the situation in this region. However, I mean, this is, I think, a very, very, you know, expected outcome. What has been left after the 2022, Azerbaijan's taking back its own territory from the occupation of Armenian forces, is that it has not been resolved. I mean, the part of the deal, the main part of the deal, was that Azerbaijan has a corridor right going through Nakhchivan and then to Turkey, and that hasn't been totally established yet. So when you leave a situation in an unrest, the problems will come up sooner or later. And I don't think, my guess is as good as yours, that Russia, in the meantime, you know, having this problem with all the things, that all the outcomes of the Russian-Ukrainian war, is not helping the situation either. But at the other end, when you don't resolve a major issue like this, you know, having the corridor between Azerbaijan and Nakhchivan, these problems will keep coming back up, and until it's resolved, I don't think there will be any true rest in the region, for at least for that particular region.
Well, let's talk about the corridor, Rustam. I mean, your perspective. Why did Azerbaijan block the crossings to Nagorno-Karabakh?
Well, basically, what they want to do, they want to suffocate the last area which not controlled by them. It's Stepanakert, the capital of a self-proclaimed Artsakh Republic, and they wanted to force Armenians to accept their terms and to restore totally control over that territory. Do not forget, in the Soviet time, it has an autonomy and self-ruled autonomy. Yeah, it was under subordination to Baku, but still, Armenian minority who mostly reside in Nagorno-Karabakh region had. So now, when war is over, Mr. Aliyev is declaring autonomy for you, like you defeated, accept our terms. And obviously, that's not how deal about establishing ceasefire was done. So obviously, Armenians are some sort of negotiations. They wanted to preserve the population of Nagorno-Karabakh. And obviously, if Azerbaijan would totally restore control militarily over the territory, all Armenians would be leaving that area because they would feel very insecure. They do not have any guarantee. In spite of all conversation, we will give them all rights if they'll accept Azerbaijani citizenship. After 30 years of confrontation, I don't think that will happen easily. So all of that create that very difficult situation. And yes, Azerbaijani side right now, increasing escalation, blocking the Lachin corridor. Before we'll talk to corridor to Nakhchivan area, only one little road which had a communication connection between Armenia and Stepanakert has to be unblocked. Otherwise, it's not fair to talk about establishing another corridor when this corridor is blocked. By what reason? There's like really no reason for that, except desire to suffocate self-proclaimed republic under economic and military pressure.
Onur, do you agree with what Rostam said about this situation? Your perspective?
There's always, more than one side to every story. And there are things that I do understand on the Armenian side. But at the end of the day, we should never forget, we're talking about sovereign Azerbaijan land. This is a sovereign Azerbaijan territory. What really blows my mind is that it took about 30 years to reclaim, for Azerbaijan to reclaim her own, sovereign land. And that probably had a lot to do, which history will tell us very soon, that probably had a lot to do with Russian pressure and the Russian, politics in that region. So it just really blows my mind that we're actually, most of these things we're talking about, we're actually talking about a sovereign state's own territory, own sovereign land. How, you know, as I said, having said that, I'm not saying that today or yesterday, there are not issues with the Armenian population there, which needs to be addressed. But hey, for 30 years, besides issues, actually a matter of life and death has not ever been looked upon for the Azerbaijan Turks in the region. So, things should be looked after. But if you compare, and we should never, but if you compare the tragedies on both sides, the Armenian population falls, well below what the Azerbaijani Turks had lived for the last 30 years in that region. So, yes, there are issues. They need to be addressed. But we must never forget that we're talking about, in all these talks, we're talking about the sovereign land of a sovereign state of Azerbaijan. So that should never be forgotten, because sometimes it is. Sometimes we're talking about these pseudo states, these pseudo claims over territories, which is just not true. Borders are set. They are what they are, period.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Rostam, I want to look at another aspect of this, because Azerbaijan has a very close relationship with Israel. Do you see Israel playing any role in the increased tensions that are taking place?
Maybe something undercover exists, but obviously I don't see any obvious desire of Israel to complicate that situation. Obviously, Israel could be worrying about Iranian and Armenian cooperation in some areas, but I don't think they will deliberately instigate conflict potential in that area, because it's not always how Israel could benefit from that.
Okay, and what about Turkey, Onar? Let's talk about Turkey's role in this conflict.
Well, Turkey has direct interest. We're talking about Azerbaijani Turks. We're talking about, the official concept of Turkey, and both Turkey and Azerbaijan is one nation, two states. So it has more than political, more than geopolitical reasons to get involved. It actually accepts, and I think this is for both sides, Azerbaijan as a sister state of the same nation with just two different states. So you could always bet on, I would see, on both sides that both countries will seek after each other's stakes at all costs. I don't think, at least from the side of Turkey, which I could vouch for, this will not change no matter what the situation is. So this is not the relationship between the two states are probably none, exists no in nowhere else in the world. maybe to a certain degree, with the exception of Greece and the southern state of Cyprus, Greek Cypriot southern state of Cyprus.
Okay, well, Rostam, looking at the situation right now, because Armenia is trying to, it appears, distance itself from Moscow right now, and actually has recently announced about the joint war games that we'll be having with the United States soon. I want to look at that side of things. Your perspective about, first of all, Armenia distancing itself from Russia, and now Armenia wanting to have these war games, or the U.S. wanting to have these war games with Armenia?
I think Mr. Pashinyan is right now feel very desperate in that situation, trying to find some balance and resist to Azerbaijani pressure and avoid a new military defeat. And by doing that, he's just kind of erratically jumping from one side to another. That's from one hand. It's dictated by a recent situation. But from another hand, if we remember what happened a few years ago when Nikol Pashinyan took power in Armenia, it was protest against ruling elite, which came from actually Karabakh area, and people rebelled against it because it felt it's very corrupt and too much maybe pro-Russian. And Pashinyan was like trying to bring another alternative orientation to the West. It didn't work in that time. He again moved towards the Russian side, towards the Kremlin. But after military defeat, some disillusion happened, at least for us, for Pashinyan, and he decided to switch sides and start to move towards the West by hoping maybe the West will be better broker than Moscow in that process of negotiations, the terms of the peace with Azerbaijan. So that's what how I see the dynamic of activity of Armenian leadership in the last few years.
Hmm. Onur, what's your take on that? With it appears to be a type of geopolitical switch that Armenia seems to be going after with these war games. Let's talk about the effect you think that can play. Let me say that Iran has said that it will not allow any geopolitical changes to the borders in the Caucasus region, and also actually says bringing in entities from outside the region is not helpful but will make the situation worse.
I mean, yes, you know, bringing in outside parties will make the situation worse. Actually, one can very easily, debate the fact that even Russia's involvement may be, worsening the situation. But it seems, and this is just really a feeling or a hunch, that Armenia probably with the pressure of the diaspora is somehow does seem that it may be playing more into the hands of the U.S. And the U.S. these days obviously is looking for every which way to to corner or pressure Russia in any way, shape or form that he can, she can. So yes, it might happen. It may be the reason because of the U.S. or even United Kingdom to a certain degree, and maybe France. But the thing is, you involve more at least non-regional powers into this equation, it's going to get worse. If you ask me, even the involvement of Russia is very questionable as to whether it's actually helping the situation or doing it exact otherwise. So yes, I will give him that, and I do see Pashinyan's somewhat of a shift towards the Russian politics. I personally attribute it to a situation where US may be trying to pressure Armenia to do this, or trying to quote-unquote bribe Armenia to do this. So it actually corners it. Probably they would have no interest in the actual situation, but it would just be yet another a pressure point for US to hold against Russia at this point in time.
Well, Rostam, in your opinion, with everything that is going on right now, how likely is it that we will see another all-out war between these two countries?
I think we're getting very close to that, but we'll see how secret diplomacy would work in the closest time, because if nothing will happen in negotiations between leaders of Turkey, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russia, yes, war could break out under the circumstances. It's required immediate measures, this situation, because we know already by observing in the last few years conflict in that area and conflict between Russia and Ukraine, it's very easy to start a war, and it's very difficult to finish that and find a solution which would be acceptable for all sides. So, yes, I would say it's like 50-50.
Onur, Armenia has contacted Iran, Europe, and the U.S. now to help prevent another war. Your perspective, what must be done in order to avert another war?
Well, first of all, at this point in time, and time is always very imperative in solving, international diplomatic situations. So what you can do today or what you could do today, you may not be able to do tomorrow and vice versa. I think at this time, all sides, there should be a voice of reason to calm all sides down, because with the situation in Ukraine escalating to a certain degree, I don't think this is the right time to make a major move, because it will, it's just looking for a spark to maybe there may be some nations, some states that is looking for a spark to escalate these things. So I would say that, at this time, I think everybody should kind of tone down a little bit on all sides. But at the same time, never forget that there are certain things that must be done that was talked at ending the war between, or reclaiming Azerbaijani land back to its official borders. There were some certain things that were agreed upon. I think that should be worked on and mm-hmm. finalized immediately. None of those really need Russian or anybody else's approval. Those were things that were set on the table. I think they should be done. And will that resolve the problems in the region? Not likely, not anytime soon, but I don't think this is a very good time to, yet escalate matters in a very close region to Ukraine and Russia at this point in time. So I think diplomacy has a lot of things, a lot of legwork to do in these days, because just keep every side happy for a little longer till this thing is over between Russia and Ukraine. Then it may be a time to actually, completely resolve some of the main issues that are actually creating problems in the region.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Rostam Savrinov, political analyst out of D.C. Onur Erem, political analyst out of Istanbul. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
If the military contractors' Thai buybacks come proportionately from the different revenue streams of the company, U.S. taxpayers underwrote $5.8 billion in Lockheed Martin buybacks in 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams reported the value of Lockheed Martin's stock grew by 37% last year, representing an incredible financial gain for investors in the U.S. largest military contractor. This spike was hardly the result of changing market conditions, however. The S&P 500 ended the year with growth of -20%. Instead, this growth came from stock buybacks. In 2022, the company bought back more of its own stock than in any other year in its history, $7.9 billion, equivalent to 12% of its sales income. According to Lockheed's 2022 annual report, 73.5% of the company's sales last year were to the U.S. government, most of which were for the Department of Defense. In other words, if these buybacks come proportionately from the different revenue streams of the company, U.S. taxpayers underwrote $5.8 billion in Lockheed buybacks. This is without including foreign military sales, roughly another 19.2% of the total, which are sold to foreign governments through the U.S. government. When contractors who receive most of their money from government sales issue buybacks, it is ultimately taxpayer dollars being redirected towards shareholders' pockets. Data from Lockheed Martin's annual report suggests that company outdid itself in 2022, offering its investors a record level of taxpayer-backed buybacks equivalent to the prior 4 years combined. This isn't a new phenomenon. Since 1982, U.S. corporations have been able to buy back their own stock in order to raise the value of their remaining stock, an investor payout similar to dividends, but with a smaller tax bill. The rapid growth of stock buybacks since then has attracted its fair share of critics, who argue that the money spent on them would be better used on research and development or wages, rather than enriching shareholders. The Pentagon directs about half of its $858 billion budget to private contractors, making it a prime target for companies looking to get their hands on government cash. Indeed, Lockheed isn't the only weapons company issuing massive stock buybacks. 2021 was a record year for the sector in this regard. But Lockheed's latest numbers dwarf their competitors. Their 2022 buybacks were worth more than those of Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, BAE Systems, and the L3Harris combined. Boeing, formerly a major spender on repurchases, suspended their buyback program in 2020 in response to scandals surrounding their commercial airlines. Lockheed Martin has increasingly focused on buybacks to create high returns for investors over the last several years. Corporate leadership authorized $5 billion in new buybacks in the fall of 2021 and another $14 billion in the fall of 2022. The remaining funds, not already spent this year, are expected to be utilized over a three-year period, according to a Lockheed press release. During last year's Q4 earnings call, Lockheed Martin CEO Jim Taiclet bragged that the company's buybacks and dividends delivered approximately $11 billion to shareholders in 2022 and that they expect to complete the remaining repurchase authorization of $10 billion over the next few years. Executives made it a priority to increase cash returns to shareholders with a significant increase to share repurchases. Overall, Taiclet said the company ended the year with a total shareholder return of 40%. With the majority of Lockheed's revenue coming from the government, what Taiclet is really saying is that U.S. taxpayers helped to pay the company's shareholders. Bolstered by new sales related to Russia-Ukraine crisis, the company seems committed to continuing the use of buybacks. In their most recent release of financial information, Taiclet said that they are confident in our return to growth and ability to reward our shareholders over the long run with reliable free cash flow, per share expansion, and cash deployment. The $5.8 billion share of Lockheed Martin's buybacks, enabled by government funding, serves little purpose beyond further enriching investors. Yet, it costs more than nine times what recently proposed cuts to food stamps would have raised each year in their original form. The military itself has raised alarms about its contractors' use of buybacks. A report from the Pentagon earlier this year found that when comparing the 2010s to 2000s, defense contractors chose to reduce the overall share of revenue spent on independent research and development and capital expenditures, while significantly increasing the share of revenue paid to shareholders in cash dividends and share buybacks by 73%. These problems have not gone unnoticed. Senator Elizabeth Warren has been particularly vocal about the harmful implications of these trends. As major defense contractors brag to their shareholders about increasing dividends and buybacks, they can't expect taxpayers to further underwrite their profits. But until reforms are made which limit buybacks or reform the contracting process, the companies involved will continue to expect exactly that. Lockheed Martin did not respond to a request for RS for comment for this story. CNBC had earlier reported Lockheed Martin is the top-grossing defense firm in the world, and the U.S. government supports that business to the tune of more than $37.7 billion. In 2018 alone, that business from government contracts represented 70% of Lockheed Martin's $53.7 billion revenue for the year, as it bid out its contemporaries Boeing and Raytheon. These funds are granted by U.S. Congress to provide equipment that enables the U.S. military to protect the country at home and abroad. To ensure that politicians work with defense contractors to provide equipment to the military, this partnership creates a unique opportunity for private corporations to execute the will of the government and requires a delicate balance.
Bye. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. sidelines, Iran's president says the country has full authority over its recently unblocked assets in South Korea and will spend those funds where they're needed. Two Israeli settlers are injured, one of them critically after their car comes under fire.